Imagine I had a barrel of apples on my side. Getting that first apple out the barrel is quite easy. I just go to the top of the barrel, it's full, and I lift the apple out, and there it is. As I go down in the barrel, I have to exert a bit more work because I've got to stretch down further, but I still get an apple out. And when I come to the very bottom, I've got to stretch down quite a long way, and I still get an apple out. So I'm always getting an apple. And when you use oil, you're always getting a barrel of oil. But the amount of energy that you have to exert to get that barrel of oil increases over time. So in terms of the oil and gas system, it's not going to be net energy positive in any sense by 2031, which is only about 7 years away.
Hello and welcome to Planet Critical, the podcast for a world in crisis. My name is Rachel Donald. I'm a climate corruption journalist and your host. Every week, I interview experts who are battling to save our planet. My guests are scientists, politicians, academics, journalists, and activists. They explain the complexities of the energy, economic, political, and cultural crises we face today, revealing what's really going on and what they think needs to be done. These are the stories of the big picture. Go to planetcritical.com to learn more and subscribe. My guest this week is Alistair Hamilton. Alistair is a researcher at the School of Engineering at the University of Edinburgh and also works on Scotland's energy transition with his company, Zero Emission Scotland. Alistair joined me today to explain one thing. The oil crash is coming, and sooner than we think. He and a team of collaborators created a thermodynamic model for understanding energy input and energy output. They spent a few years analysing the data from around the world, including the North Sea, Norway, and Alaska. And they found that thermodynamically, we just can no longer balance the books on extracting fossil fuels. Everything we do expends energy. Pulling oil out of the ground costs energy. Getting gas out of the ground costs energy. Building a wind turbine costs energy. Everything costs energy. But normally when we talk about our fuel reserves, geologists talk about the number of barrels of oil available. That doesn't take into consideration how much energy we're spending to get those barrels out of the ground. What Alistair explained in this conversation is that the deeper you go, the more energy you expend to get access to that fuel. He also explains that because we use fossil fuels very inefficiently, burning off between 35 and 40% of them, we need to take that into consideration when thinking about how much fuel we have in a barrel of oil. Using this thermodynamic model of how much energy we spend versus how much we get, Alistair and his team concluded with some really shocking figures. In the North Sea, oil and gas will no longer be net energy positive by 2031. In fact, it's already not energy positive, but the energy we extract from there is subsidized. Norway's not far behind, even factoring in energy subsidies. It will no longer be energy positive by 2032. Alistair walks us through the model and the data to explain how they came to those conclusions. We then discuss the fact that policymakers around the world are not taking this data into consideration, given the continuing expansion of the oil and gas industry. We also discuss how dangerous it is to use the last of our fuels, even if they are fossil fuels, to continue business as usual, rather than dramatically ramp up different energy infrastructure. Alistair then gives some insight into the same depletions in quality that we're seeing in the mining industry, before ending with some technological solutions that are rarely discussed, and also one major political solution. We need to decentralize our energy systems as fast as possible. I hope you all enjoy the episode. If you do, please share it far and wide. And if you're loving the show, support Planet Critical with a paid subscription at planetcritical.com. By signing up, you'll get the Planet Critical newsletter inspired by each episode delivered straight to your inbox every week. You'll also have access to the wonderful Planet Critical community, who are full of inspiring thoughts, ideas, critiques, and determination. I'm so grateful to everyone who chooses to support the project. I'm a vehement believer in ad-free and open-access content, so Planet Critical wouldn't exist without the direct support of the amazing community. Thank you so much to all of you who believe in Planet Critical and keep the project going every week. Alistair, thank you very much for joining me. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So why is the world in crisis?
The world is in crisis because there's an unseen, hidden energy crisis underway that's off the radar of virtually everyone, but can be seen if we apply science and engineering to study it. So we've built a tool to do that. And it's really that what I'd like to talk about today.
Excellent. So let's dive straight in. What is this tool?
This tool is a thermodynamic model of oil production. And this came about really from some mining engineers in the States who'd taken this approach to modeling oil depletion, which is different from the way geologists do it. We tend to look at the number of barrels produced and project the number of barrels that are going to be produced in the future. And there's a great deal of discussion about this, of course, about 20 years ago when the peak oil topic was in the media quite a lot. And some very eminent people were saying that we're heading for a crisis. So people like Colin Campbell, who was a eminent oil geologist and wrote a book called Oil Crisis. In fact, I've got it here, that raised the alarm, basically. But they were looking at a per barrels metric for oil production. And of course, peak conventional oil, in fact, did come along around about 2005, but the waters were muddied by all kinds of debate. And then along came shale oil, and everyone thought our problems are finished.
I think we need to pause and explain to some listeners here, what is peak oil?
Okay, peak oil is a concept whereby production starts at zero and then rises to a peak up over time and then declines thereafter. And that concept was first proposed by Marion King Hubbert, who is a shale geologist in the 1950s. In fact, he said that peak oil, the United States, would occur around about 1970. And everyone kind of scoffed at that. Of course, he was proved right.
Wow. So from what I understand a little bit about peak oil, from the other researchers that I've spoken to, they say that globally we hit peak oil around 2008, I believe. Is that about right?
Yeah, I'd say, 2005, 2006, 2008. Yeah, it's around about that date. Yeah, I think the actual specific day or month or year is not too critical. It's more the fact that this has happened and is in the rear view mirror, as it were.
So we've hit peak oil, which means that we're now expecting or have been expecting oil to deplete. But you mentioned shale. And fracking, yeah. How would that have impacted our access to oil?
Okay, so there was a run-up in price, the price of oil, around about that time, around about 2005. And the price went up to about $147 a barrel. And of course, humans are very innovative, and technology progresses. And perhaps one of the most technologically innovative places is the United States. And of course, it's a large country, and they had what they call shale reserves of oil, which are a precursor, if you like, to conventional oil, in that these are the source rocks where conventional oil is formed, if you like, before migrating to the reservoirs over, you know, hundreds of thousands of years or millions of years. So American conventional oil peaked in 1970, and then they opened up Alaska for oil production. But still, production continued to decline throughout the 80s and 90s. And their conventional base of oil kind of plateaued out. But round about the time of peak oil, peak conventional oil, then the innovative Americans started producing oil from the source rocks, which is the shale, if you like. And what they did was called fracking, which was an existing technology, and horizontal drilling. So they did an awful lot of drilling and injecting of sand and explosives to crack open the source rocks and extract the oil, if you like, from within the source rocks themselves. So it wasn't a conventional oil production process. It was something that was not completely new, but new, used at this scale. And of course, what happened was their oil production shot up very dramatically, very quickly because of this. But if you listen to some commentators now, like this guy called Art Berman of Labyrinth Consulting, mm-hmm. who's very good at this kind of stuff, and he talks about the shale revolution, if you like, coming to an end simply because they've used the best resources. And the decline rates are very dramatic. And the amount of energy, of course, you have to put in to get the oil out itself is very high. In fact, one of my colleagues who work in a loose grouping of people who look at this have analyzed Barnett shale production. And, it, you know, in terms of the energy that you get out from these wells, it's not, you know, a vast amount, basically. It's because of the amount of work you have to do to get the oil out of the shale, basically. Fracturing rock.
Is this energy return on investment?
Yes. Yeah, so we look at energy return on investment. But our approach is a different approach, and it was first suggested by mining engineers in the States. And they had a website about 10 years ago that had this, proposed this technique and had their results on it. It generated quite a bit of discussion. And I'd been a bit of a geek in reading about this stuff for the last 20 years and came across this work, and it took a lot of getting your head around it. And it seemed to be, you know, it was like the aha moment, you know, here's the technique that's based in data that will give us a much more predictable measure of how oil is depleting, but not from point of view of the number of barrels per day that's produced, but in terms of the energy that's produced. And because, you know, the energy, or you can work out using this technique, the amount of energy it takes to produce oil, you also know how much energy is in the oil, because that's defined by the chemical composition of the oil itself. So from that, you can work out energy return or an energy invested. But yes, this relates to that. And in fact, in the reports that are shared with you that we produced, you can see there's some very nice graphs of that for the different regions that we've analyzed. The UK is one of the very few countries or regions that produce or provide all the data that you require to fit this model. The mining engineers were having to kind of extrapolate things. So their report was quite long and doubly mind-bending because of that. But it occurred to me that in the UK, we have all this data. So some of it I knew was readily available through the website of the North Sea Transition Authority, as it's called now. It used to be the Oil and Gas Authority. But they produce all the production data from the reservoirs in the UK. And because we were taking a thermodynamic approach, we needed that data, but we also needed temperature data. And that can be found in a number of different ways, but the most definitive source would be publications that contained a list of the temperatures of all the reservoirs in the on the UK continental shelf, for example. And it turns out that geologists, through the Geological Society of London, produced a Millennium Atlas that contained all that information. The bottom line is if you look at the temperature of the reservoirs on the UK continental shelf, on average and adjusted for production, the average temperature is 100 degrees C, which is a nice round number.
That'd be something easy for me to remember. Very helpful. I think before we go into the situation in the North Sea and then use that to extrapolate also what's going on globally, just to sort of summarize. So energy return on investment would be the fact that we have to use energy, do useful work in order to get fossil fuels out of the ground. And the further they are from the surface, the more energy it takes to get them up and out. And that coupled with the fact that conventional oil is more energy dense and shale oil is just a less rich energy source. And as you go further down, that means you're putting more energy in to get less energy out. And there's going to be a moment where it no longer makes sense to get that energy out. How close are we to that moment, I suppose, is one question. And the other would be, what is the case with the reserves that are around the world?
I think you put that very well. I was going to give you a little analogy, if I could.
Please.
That was really... And I've got a prop. So I've got a prop. So here's my prop. So this is an apple, as you can see. And I'm not going to start eating it. But if you imagine I had a barrel of apples on my side that went all the way down to the floor, then actually, for me, sitting here, getting that first apple out of the barrel is quite easy. I just go to the top of the barrel, it's full, the barrel, and I lift the apple out, and there it is. So it's an apple. As I go down in the barrel, I have to exert a bit more work because I've got to stretch down further, but I still get an apple out. And when I come to the very bottom, I've got to stretch down quite a long way, and I still get an apple out. So I'm always getting an apple. And when you use oil, you're always getting a barrel of oil, let's say, as a measure. But the amount of energy that you have to exert to get that barrel of oil increases over time. Okay. Oh. And it's really that we're trying to work out.
So am I incorrect in thinking that there is a difference in energy density between sort of conventional oil and shale oil? Because from what I've heard, it's sort of people talk about it as if it's lower quality.
You're not incorrect. But what we were doing was looking at the UK, and in the UK, there's a very narrow band of oils that are produced, but more globally than there are heavy oils and light oils. But in the context of the UK, it was quite a narrow band.
Right.
And in fact, we graphed that in our report. So you can see how the API of the oil has changed over time. So yes.
What's an API?
It's basically a measure of the density of the oil, therefore how useful it is for different applications.
All right. Okay. So thank you for clarifying that. I think then the question really that we need to answer is how far away from this critical moment when reaching down into the barrel of apples is going to take more energy than getting up the apple?
Yeah, it's... Okay. Well, funnily enough, we were doing this work in the summer of 2021. And then in the first part of 2022. And we were, at that point, we were working on the UK continental shelf. So we're trying to get, we had most of the data, but we were struggling to find the thermal data. We were reading a lot of papers and looking at all sorts of metrics, talking to oil geologists. One of the advantages I had was because I work in a university and there's in the School of Engineering, and there's a School of Geoscience nearby. One of the emeritus professors had actually contacted me because he'd heard about my work in this area, and he wanted to talk to me. And basically, I thought I was going to get into trouble, but he was very helpful. So he was able to provide me with contacts to help us find things like bottom hole temperatures, which are, taken at when you drill wells. And in fact, some of those are recorded by the North Sea Transition Authority. But that was kind of problematic because you need to correct for, the heat that the drilling process incurs when these measurements are taken. So they need to be corrected. And I thought the definitive thermal characteristic would be the temperature of the reserve itself. And some papers, academic papers had produced that, but it was only when we found the Millennium Atlas that we found the whole temperature records for all of the UK continental shelf, and indeed Norway.
Maybe we should define what happens when it takes too much energy to retrieve a thing. Oil production then stops, doesn't it? Or it has to be massively, massively subsidized by something else, which would make very little sense. So, I mean, what we're talking about here is the access to our main source of fuel, which is hugely problematic and warming the planet and all those kinds of things, but the access to our main source of fuel drying up and nobody seemingly putting plans into place to accommodate for the fact that these reserves are depleting very quickly. Is that correct?
Yes, I think that's broadly correct. So when we're doing this work in 2021-2022, it so happened that what our results were telling us for the UK continental shelf was that that was just the time when we were crossing the maximum energy that you could get from the oil itself, the amount of energy that it was contained within the oil. But so that was happening in 2021-2022. We're crossing this threshold. However, we typically burn oil for use in transport, let's say, the typical application. Most of the oil goes into jet fuel or diesel or petrol to power our transport system. And because you're burning it, then you don't get as much usable energy out. There's something called a Carnot efficiency. So there's a lower threshold that you pass. And of course, anecdotally, you've probably seen cars going down the road that are belching blue or black smoke. So these are driving inefficiently. So, you know, there's perhaps some threshold in where that limit sits, perhaps a bit lower than the Carnot efficiency. So we think that the UK production, in fact, from our analysis, the UK production passed that lower threshold in 2015. So it seems that from the point of view of transport fuels, then it's required an energy subsidy from 2015. And by 2021, we'd passed the threshold of the total amount of energy within the oil itself.
Oh, wow. So let me just kind of tease that out a little bit less technically, if I may.
Okay.
So because we burn off oil, and that's how we sort of produce this fuel for our transport. What is it? I think it's 35%, 40% is sort of lost. It's
yes.
Very inefficient.
Yes.
And so because of that already, that 35-40%, we have to factor that into thinking about how much energy we're actually getting out of those barrels to do the work that we want.
Yes.
And so using that lower threshold.
Yes.
Right. So using that lower threshold, the UK has been using an energy subsidy from somewhere else because we're already using more than we're producing based on that. Right. Okay.
Yeah. That's all very simplistic, however, because, you know, oil is traded, you know, but if we think about it in those kind of more simplistic terms, I think that's helpful. So then what we can do is we can expand our model and say, okay, our model has been set up to look at oil production, but we also produce natural gas. So what we did was we took the original model and then we expanded it to factor in natural gas. And what we're doing again is the same thing. We're using thermodynamics. We have an equation. We've set up the model. It's, you know, I would say this is a, you know, it's a first order model that gives us kind of a, you know, a rule, a kind of, you know, stick your thumb in the air kind of, you know, it's not a completely detailed model, but it is sufficient, I think, to point out the problem that other people are not really pointing out. So we expanded the model to include natural gas. We had all the data on natural gas production. We had all the specific heats required, all the data were required. We had all the temperature information from the Geological Society. So we factored that in, and then we can look at when we run into trouble with oil and gas. So if you like, you might consider, okay, your oil production is going to be subsidized because you're using natural gas. Let's say you're using natural gas in the oil rig, power the oil rig, or you're using natural gas in the refinery, or you're using natural gas to make or power the equipment used elsewhere in the production and processing chain. Then we can look into that. So if we look into that, then we hit a problem around about 2024, which is about now. And we get to the, if you like, the kind of what we call the dead state, if you like, or the last threshold at 2031. So in terms of the oil and gas system, it's not going to be net energy positive in any sense by 2031, which is only about 7 years away.
I think I understand what you're saying, but when you say energy subsidy,
you mean supporting the production with energy from elsewhere, feeding in fossil fuels in order to offset some of the loss?
Well, they need to be fossil fuels. They can be fossil fuels, so you could... But one of the things that's going on in the North Sea at the moment is electrification of oil rigs. And that's being done to reduce the emissions from oil rigs. Okay. So floating wind farms are being connected to oil rigs in the North Sea. So that's effectively...
In our terms, it's
an energy subsidy, okay, because you're using wind power to power the rig to extract the oil. So it's no longer self-powered, if you like, but it's getting the subsidy from floating oil. So it's floating wind farms, okay. Now, if you think about the amount of energy that's required to produce those wind farms as well, then you can't, you're getting yourself into kind of deeper water because you need to be able to produce the oil. Now you need floating wind farms, you know. So, So there's, if we look at the energy cost of producing oil and oil and gas, we can plot it as a graph over time. And the graph is pretty boring to look at because it's just what we call an exponential function that starts some value and then rises very quickly up like that in time. Okay. So it can very quickly swamp your entire primary energy supply for indigenous primary energy supply for a nation. So we see that with the UK. And we see that happening in the early 2030s. Now, you could then say, well, you're talking a load of nonsense. You know, surely this can't be true. And I think one of the problems that a lot of people have is coming to terms with the exponential function. It's kind of, you know, quite well known. But other people have been saying this. So obviously we did a literature review. And what we came across a paper by a bunch of authors, including the lead author was Lena I. Brand Korea, if I can pronounce the name correctly. And it was in the journal Energies in 2017. And it was called Developing an Input-Output-Based Method to Estimate a National Level Energy Return on Investment. There's your phrase. And they had a graph in their paper. And obviously the graph didn't go, you know, up to 20, 21, 22. But it was a very clear trend in that graph. And if you did a linear extension of their graph, then it hit the zero axis round about now. So these people were basically saying a similar thing to what we're saying. Okay, so we're not the only canaries in the coal mine, as it were.
Oh, definitely not. I mean, I don't think I've spoken to anybody who's written a paper exactly on it, but I've spoken to a couple of researchers who have been warning about the fact that we are quite evidently running out of oil and the fact that they are not being listened to. And I suppose the question, because it's interesting speaking to you about this, because particularly with the North Sea, because we know what's happening with in the British government at the moment. Sunak's government is offering more exploration licenses for oil and gas. Starmer has said that if Labour comes in, they will not cut those licenses. But I mean, what are they going to be looking for? It seems a kind of surely a waste of time at this point, because if oil and gas is not going to be energy positive by 2031, then what we need is the massive ramping up of different kinds of energy infrastructure to catch us when that crash happens.
Yes, absolutely. And that's a matter of absolute urgency. There's no doubt about that. The problem with the current trajectory is, well, we've got this picture of what's happening in the UK. Okay. Now, the UK isn't the only oil and gas producer. You know, we import a lot of oil. A lot of oil gets shipped out of the UK from production and refined elsewhere. So we're in a global world, and the people trade. So if you look at the digest of UK energy statistics, you can find out where the rest of our oil comes from. And a large part of it comes from two sources. One is Norway, and the other one is the USA. So, well, can we apply our techniques to Norway and the USA? And the short answer is yes, it's quite easy for us to do it for Norway because we have all the same information that we required for the UK. So we've done that, and that's in our report. So, you know, I think it's fair to say that the Norwegians share a similar resource to the UK. I mean, they're just across the international boundary in the North Sea between the UK and Norway. But I think they've developed their resources perhaps a bit more strategically than the UK has. But we can work out, you know, when we hit these critical thresholds for Norwegian oil production, and they are 2027 for the, if you like, the start of the dead state, and the final date is 2032. So they're just following just the dead same exponential curve, but just slightly later than us.
Wow.
And so if you then go and look at USA, can we do that? We can look at the USA. Well, we can look at Alaska first of all, because remember, the lower states in the USA peaked in 1970. And it's quite there's a lot of interesting geopolitical things written about then. But they peaked in 1970. Then Alaska was brought online. So just a little round about the time of the North Sea coming online. And if you look at the characteristics of Alaska, it's another one of the, well, it's a region, but it's a region we can get all the data for. So we can get all the temperatures of the reservoirs. We can get all the production data. And we can work out this curve. And the dates we get for Alaska are the lower threshold is 2016. And the maximum threshold is 2021. Wow. The last time I looked at my calendar, that was a few years ago now. So very similar to the UK numbers.
So what's happened? I mean, how is policy responding to this? Because as far as I'm aware, there's been, not just in the UK, huge increases in the demand for oil and gas licenses and exploration around the world. Biden's administration has absolutely backed a huge liquefied natural gas expansion and is building pipelines all over the country. Obviously, similarly in the Middle East with Qatar now vying to kind of overtake the United States as a major exporter. There's resource wars going on over fossil fuels. I mean, I suppose they always have, but that's really quite evident at the moment. Do these, they must know, don't they know? They must know.
I don't know. I don't know whether they know or not. It's not known by me. We did an analysis. America for us is a bit more problematic because we don't have all the production. In fact, all of the rest of the world is more problematic because they don't produce the data that the UK, Norway, and Alaska do. Australia do, but there's not enough of it. But what we can do is we can look at the depth of oil reservoirs over time and look at the thermal gradients in these producing regions to get an idea of the temperature of the reservoirs and how that changes over time. So we did that, and that's in our report. And for the USA as a whole, the lower 48 states, we've got a lower threshold of 2008 and an upper threshold of 2014, which is now 10 years ago. But don't forget that America has, or still has, exorbitant privilege because they have the world's reserve currency, which is the dollar, which they can effectively print for nothing and other people use. So they're in a very kind of privileged situation, a bit like, you know, the British were when there was the British Empire. But that sort of hegemony seems to be slipping, and that slippage seems to be have been sort of sped up, if you like, by what happened surrounding Russian sanctions and the Ukraine war, and then further by what's going on with the BRICS countries. The fact that you know, Saudi wants to join the BRICS, where formerly they had been backing the dollar with the petrodollar arrangement that Henry Kissinger, who recently passed away, had kind of negotiated with the Saudis. I think that kind of tells you that, you know, America are in a wee bit of a tricky position in terms of geopolitics. And what we are seeing seems to imply they're in terms, they're a tricky position in terms of kind of energy, if you like. So the fall for them might be a lot harder.
And I mean, yeah, thanks for bringing that up. It's a hugely relevant point. I was very shocked when Saudi Arabia, they joined, I believe, on January 3rd or something of this year, along with Qatar. And it is very surprising to see former Middle Eastern allies now, you know, essentially hitching their wagon to possibly a Chinese-driven initiative. And it looks in many ways like the future is going to be electric if we can get there and use our fuel source in time. But that would guarantee a sort of different kind of world order with different people behind the wheel. But can you speak to that as well, perhaps, this idea of spending energy in order to get energy? Equally, that is what we need to do, like you mentioned with the floating wind turbines. If we need a huge ramp up in our different kinds of energy infrastructure, we're going to have to spend a huge amount of energy in order to do that. And we need to surely be using the very last supplies of our fossil fuels in order to do that.
So maybe just paraphrasing what you just said, that doesn't sound like a very sensible idea. Yes, I think that's really the conclusion, is that the current overbuild of renewables that's proposed in order to tackle things like intermittency, we're told that to have a renewable future, we need to increase mining. I was reading Ed Conway's book. I don't know if you know Ed Conway, he's the economist on Sky News, and I just think he's fantastic. He's got a book called Material World, and I highly recommend it. But he was saying that, you know, we need to take the existing largest mine for copper in the world, and we need three of them every year.
I know. And this is the thing. It's actually not entirely feasible. I don't know if you saw the UN report that came out a few weeks ago, but at the time of recording, that said that if we want to sort of electrify our energy supplies, decarbonize, say, our energy system, we're looking to increase mining by 60% around the world. And their conclusion was that is simply not feasible. We need degrowth, which is, as far as I'm aware, it's the first time degrowth has been on a UN report. Quote unquote, there are safe places left on Earth.
Yes. So anecdotally, if you talk about copper mining, that I don't know if there's a guy called Chris Martinson who talks about this, and he talks about, he's got a book that was a bestseller as well. I can't remember the name off the top of my head. But he talks about Westerners going to the United States, you know, a few hundred years ago, and being able to pick up boulders in the environment that were a high percentage of copper ore. So the mining process was going along and finding these boulders and taking them away and processing. And then apparently the miners got a bit upset because all the bigger boulders had gone, all the ones in dry land had gone, but there were some in the riverbeds. And they got a bit upset because they had to get their feet wet, not to mine the riverbeds. Then Ed Conway talks about the largest hole that humankind has produced. And how that is being mined for ore, and the fact that the tailings from the production are kind of swamping the local town. He did a wonderful video of this if you search back on Sky News, So the ore grades have gone down, and he's now talking about subsea mining. So he's talking about where the continents split apart between America and Europe, you know, from Iceland all the way down the center of the Atlantic, and ships going out there, and people even with businesses trying to extract natural resources from that environment. So subsea mining is a thing, and the energy cost of that must be extortionate. But if you talk to, maybe go back to our mining engineers that we kind of worked with at the start of this project, then they had a graph, and it showed on the sort of x-axis they had ore grades, and then up the y-axis they had energy cost of extraction. So as your ore grades go down, your energy cost of extraction goes up like that. So that's essentially what we're doing. And if we think about copper as being one material that's, you know, a very good conductor of electricity, then that's what's happening to copper, you know. So we're struggling with the energy that we're producing for most things in the world in terms of transport and driving machinery, which is oil, because that's kind of suffering from the same effect, really. And yet we need to expend a lot more energy to get these ores out of the ground. So it's not a winning strategy, that one, I would say. But there are other strategies that do win. And I've heard you talk about this. You know about this, I know, because I've listened to one of your other podcasts when I was prepping for this one. And that's to decentralize the energy system. And as I think I said to you before, in our email discussion, we need to go back to the Reverend Robert Stirling, who was a minister from Ayrshire, and listen to what he had to say, and then take advantage of 200 years of engineering and scientific advances. But basically, what he was doing was using heat. So he had an external heat engine. And if you've got an external heat engine, then you can use any source of heat you like. So it could be the sun, or you could burn biomass, or you could burn anything you have to hand. And from that, you get motion. I believe his machine, you can go and see in the Hunterian Museum in Glasgow. I've not done that yet. I'd like to go across and do that. You can produce motion, and from the motion, you can produce electricity. And in fact, these machines are being used in space. So they power spacecraft, and they're being proposed to be used in colonies on Mars, because Mars is too far from the sun to be able to use solar power. Okay.
It's too far from Earth to have humans.
Well, yes, I'd agree with that, but they are talking about it. And if you look back into the past, then in the 1970s, NASA were using Stirling engines to power vehicles that were driving around the Air Force bases of America. So there's another way possible.
Can you speak a little bit more to the decentralizing our energy system idea? What exactly or broadly would that look like?
Well, we have very centralized power generation at the moment. So we have coal-fired power stations, we have gas-fired power stations, we have nuclear power stations. We have wind farms that are usually in remote places that are good for wind, because we tend not to live where the winds are high, unless you live in Scotland, of course. But in general, wind farms are kind of on, you know, in open areas away from populations. And now they're going into the North Sea, because that's got a good wind resource. And other things like, you know, so always you look for, where the energy is concentrated. So, you know, if it's oil fields, you look for the biggest and you use that first. If you're using wind, you look for the best winds and try and use that. And if you're using tides, you look for the best tides, which is why this tidal energy can be produced from the Pen and Firth between the mainland of Scotland and Orkney, because that's a concentration of water flow. So that's typically the model, and that kind of, I guess, suits a capitalist kind of point of view. But there's been many attempts to do things slightly differently, to perhaps have cogeneration. So perhaps you have a gas boiler and you cogenerate electricity by using some kind of heat engine in order to turn a turbine to produce electricity from the waste heat. So that is distributed, if you like. I'm not going to claim much credit for this because I haven't really done enough original thinking on it. It's really one of my collaborators, Louis Arnoux, who's done endless thinking on this and got endless detailed calculations, plans, etc., to implement this. And is the way my work is being used at the moment is to try and leverage funding for the sort of vision that Louis has. Okay. So for that, you need a demonstrator. So Louis is looking, I think, for about 25 million euros in order to be able to demonstrate a suite of technologies that solve all the issues associated with our current predicament, as I've been discussing. So that is heartening. But we need to kind of get that funded, and we need to get on with it. So I would really recommend, as someone else to have on your show, and I've spoken to Louis and he's very keen to come on your show, would be to talk to Louis Arnoux of Forced Transition Limited. He was the former director of the energy research program for the New Zealand government. He's a wee bit older than me. He's been around a long time and has an incredible depth of experience and knowledge in this area. And a vision to get our way out, as including carbon capture from the atmosphere. So
Wonderful. You've platformed him even before the end. Excellent. I will be sure to reach out to him.
Yeah.
I think one sort of important line of inquiry, and then we can wrap up, but it's, have you tried to get this in front of policymakers?
Yes.
I'm assuming you have. And what has their response been?
So in 2016, I approached the Scottish government. I wrote to the First Minister and I got a reply from their economics unit, and they said, basically, other people are saying a similar thing and we'll take into account your considerations in terms of policy. I then became director of the Electric Vehicle Association Scotland, really with a view to helping that community first and foremost, but also it gave me a chance to speak to Scottish ministers. So Kate Forbes, for example, was one who I put this in front of, and her research was brilliant. They were very good at taking on board the information that I provided. And of course, the Scottish government have come up with a whole lot of targets that were kind of leading. But I still think the more subtle message hasn't got through yet. I gave my report to Sir David King via the university apparatus where I work, but I haven't had a response from him. So I guess he's a very eminent person, very busy. So had Nicola Sturgeon had an electric motorhome taken from her driveway in recently, then I think it would have been a sign she's paying more attention to what I had to say. Maybe we need to cut that out.
It's an interesting strategy, I think, framing around driving, because driving on both sides of the political aisle is sort of seen as a form of like libertarian, self-sovereignty, whether it's fossil or electric. Obviously, I think we should scrap all cars and just have amazing public transport. But it's a really great frame or way to like shoehorn this into a conversation, because this is going to impact everyone. In fact, one of my favorite lines in your report was in the conclusion when you said that, you know, cars, which on average have a lifespan of 13.9 years, bought, you know, in the year sort of 2020s, are going to run out of fuel before they actually serve their time, essentially. Yeah. And I think that this would speak to a lot of people, especially given most people can't afford an electric vehicle. And thus that brings us quite nicely back to the public transport point. Are you seeing anything in the Scottish government's policies now which give you some hope around their their understanding of an energy transition or their understanding of what's going on? Or do you think that the powers that be have kind of failed to grasp this?
Well, what we're seeing is very, at the moment, is very niche. And one of the reasons for coming to talk to you about this is because to try and just talk about it and try and get some publicity. It's very niche, our point of view, but it needs to get across more. And it's very difficult to, you know, what politicians need is solutions. You don't want to go and tell them that the sky is falling. You know, you want to tell them the sky is falling and we know how to fix it. Yeah. And this is what you need to do. So that's really why Louis's work is so important. You know, I can come and talk about this kind of stuff, give you her perspective on it, but really the solution space is where you want to be, because, you know, if you get every home or every other home fitted with some kind of device that can produce, you know, works on sort of sound thermodynamic crystals, like a Stirling engine. I'm not saying a Stirling engine, but like that. And it can produce all the heat you need and just all the electrical power you need. You can store energy in a thermal store. You can monetize that. It can be the basis of your currency. You can sell it to your neighbors through a kind of interconnected mesh network. There's a lot of things spring from that, including, and politicians really like this, is jobs. And that this kind of technology maps into the general kind of heat pump area. It's just a lot more kind of comprehensive than that, because you need heat at a lot of different temperatures, you know, whether you're heating water for a shower or whatever, or you're heating an oven, or you're doing other tasks, and you need cooling, for refrigeration, freezing. So you need a lot of different kind of thermal outputs, and that can be done, you know, using heat pumps or heat converters, based on this kind of engine type, if you like, and associated technology. So the good news really is the technology is all there to do this. What we really need is a demonstrator, and that's what Louis is pushing to try and get funded. And that's the sort of thing that could be funded by government, I suppose, or could be funded by, you know, investors, and would lead to a transition that has a lot more credibility, in my view, than trying to fight these curves that are all going the wrong way from your perspective in terms of, you know, the energy cost of extracting gas and oil and the energy cost of doing all that mining that you have to do. So that, you know, that is a very attractive package. It's also a tremendous business opportunity, if you think about it, because this can scale. What Louis says is that, our energy system is only 12% efficient. Okay, so we're wasting, 88% of the energy is just kind of going out the window, as it were. So if you redesign your energy system to be a bit more like nature, okay, because nature does it. I mean, if you look out the window, there's all kinds of trees and plants and animals quite happily existing. We haven't quite figured out how to do it yet. That's our problem, without destroying the environment. And I think what Louis is proposing is a great big ray of sunshine into all this.
I cannot wait to speak with Louis. This has been really interesting. Thank you so much, Alistair. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your work.
Thank you for having me.
If you want to learn more, I've put links to everything over on planetcritical.com, where you can subscribe to support this podcast and read the weekly newsletter inspired by each interview. If you liked this episode, leave a review and share it far and wide. If you loved it, choose a paid subscription at planetcritical.com to join the community. As always, my deepest thanks to that community. Planet Critical wouldn't exist without your support. Thank you, everyone, for listening and for coming on this journey together.